canine detection collaborative, a detection dog training trio with Stacey Barnett.
Hi.
Robin Grubel.
Hey there.
And Crystal Wing.
What's up?
With humor and a big dose of theory, our trio talks practical training advice and features interviews with top trainers and scientists.
It's Canine Detection Collaborative!
Hi, everybody. This is Robin Grubel, and we are here for a very special episode of the Canine Detection Collaborative. I'm here with Stacey Barnett.
Hello.
And we have three very special guests this evening. I'm going to start Lauren DeGrief.
Hi.
Michelle Mon.
Hello, hello.
And Jenna Gadberry.
Hello.
And you guys just released a study that we're going to get to in a second. But first and foremost, can you guys each give us like a, this is who I am, this is what I do, and this is, and then we'll get into the study from there. Lauren, go ahead.
I am a chemist. I am a professor at Florida International University. I teach forensic chemistry, and I study the chemistry of odor as it relates to canine detection.
All right. Michelle.
My name is Michelle Mon. I am a contract research scientist for the U.S. Army's Combat Capabilities Development Command Chemical Biological Center, shortened to DEVCOM CBC. And in that role, I am the research scientist that works on the olfactory sciences portfolio for military working dogs.
And Miss Jenna.
I am Michelle's administrative assistant at DEVCOM CBC. Over.
Okay, because that's all you do. All right. So you guys just released this super fantastic study about explosives dogs and training aids associated with explosives dogs. Give us like the 10,000 foot practitioner view of that.
Sure. So we tested a bunch of commercially available and a couple of novel explosives training aids. We did testing in the lab to see what they smell like according to our instruments. And then we did a little bit of canine testing as well to see how useful they are as training aids.
So when you say novel training aid, what does that mean?
So one that wasn't commercially available, but all of them are non-detonable training aids. So they're all alternative training aids, meaning that they are not the real piece of explosive. They are somehow changed in a manner that makes them non-detonable.
So they won't actually explode.
Correct.
Okay.
Non-detonable and non-hazardous.
That is how they're marketed.
Okay, so
two positives, two very, very big positives.
Big positives. Absolutely. So what's the difference? So why would we care if they're non-hazardous?
All right, so non-hazardous, we have these people create these chemically derived training aids. Mm-hmm. And we also need to make sure that those chemicals are not going to harm the animal nor the handler from being around them from pure exposure.
Now the explosives that you were dealing with, because I'm looking at the paper, there's two different types of explosives that you were focused on. Is that correct?
A variety.
A variety? Okay.
So we looked at some of the more traditional nitro aromatics, which are like the C4 or RDX containing and PETN. But we did a smaller study with those. The main bulk of the study was with the peroxide explosives, which are TTP and HMTD.
And so are those like especially hazardous? I mean, well, they're all hazardous. Let's be real. But in terms of the challenge, I guess what I'm trying to understand is the challenges of training on these specific substances.
Yeah, they're very different. So all of the explosives are difficult to legally have for, you know, a variety of reasons. However, things like C4 are not likely to go off by you handling them. You could drop it, you can jump up and down on it, you can light it on fire, it's not going to explode. So that working with those is more of a legal issue than it is, and it's less of a safety issue. I'm not saying it's not a safety issue, it is less of one. As compared to something like the peroxide explosives, which are drop sensitive, friction sensitive, so they can go off accidentally quite quite readily and even in small quantities. So there's definitely a danger with working with those for people.
Would you refer to them as highly sensitive, Dr. DeGrief?
I don't know what the exact definition of highly sensitive is, but yes.
I appreciate that we like definitions. So I would assume some of the peroxide stuff is something, A, you don't want to handle with your bare hands.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not quite the stuff that you shouldn't jump up and down on it.
Yeah, you don't want to handle it. I don't like handling it even in the lab, even when it is nice, pure FBI made stuff. There are definitely stories of people accidentally setting off half a gram and, you know, putting a small hole in their hand in a laboratory setting. So we don't like that. And then of course it's very hard to explain that to a dog. So
yeah. Don't muzzle punch it, please.
I'm kind of picturing, I went through this whole retraining of just containers with my dog Powder, as she actually, it's kind of a funny name for that type of anything. Anyway, and I'm picturing this in my head thinking she would have had an extremely short career. I mean, we fixed it, but I can imagine that. I mean, that dogs can be a little bit,
unpredictable.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. Exactly.
I could definitely see that as I think about some of the bomb dogs I've seen that will do muzzle punching or bark at source. And yeah, that's not fun.
Yeah, because the barking is the vibrations, right?
Right.
That you have to worry about. Okay.
So it's not to say that there aren't ways to train with real in a safe manner. It's just a lot more complicated to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
So for the canine assessments, you guys had two groups of dogs, and how did you have them specifically trained? And one of the things, there's a lot of misconceptions about, oh my gosh, why are you only using four dogs in a study? Or why are you only using six dogs in a study? And so tell us why you are only, that's a common number for a lot of studies. And then you guys had more than that. So tell us about the groups of dogs that you had.
We had 12 military working dogs that were green, i.e. naive to odor. And we broke those up into two equal groups, but also allowed for a washout in each group. So ideally, we would have had 5 in the experimental group and 5 in the control group. And that is indeed how it ended up working. We had a dog that was unable to complete the study due to Giardia. And there was another one that I forget what the reason was. So at the end, we did end up with 5 and 5. And it's just extremely limiting working with dogs that require that they are green. So there's tons of operational dogs out there. There's not a ton of green dogs that have the right age and maturity for us to be working with. So it does come down to money, and it also does come down to some of the logistics involved in having these type of dogs.
So you mentioned green dogs are naive to odor. Can you explain to us kind of, you know, why you might pick those rather than operational dogs?
Absolutely. So if you're doing a generalization study, which in sort of broad terms, I would consider the work that we did here, and we have to be sure that the dog is generalizing from one thing to another without any confounders in the data. Mm-hmm. And so those confounders could be that the dog's previous detection history would allow it to generalize more so than the dogs that we're using that are basically a blank slate. And so there's a lot of anecdote or you know, people will sort of run their own quote unquote studies within their kennels or what have you. And those dogs aren't green. And the dogs may generalize from one thing to another, but they can't necessarily have causation or how that dog is doing it. And even though it may be correlated, correlation does not equal causation. And so for scientific studies, we need to have something stronger than just correlation. We do want to point towards causation. And so that's why we use green dogs.
Makes sense. Makes sense. Did you have any other kind of selection criteria, or was it kind of?
Yes. Yeah. The dogs were hand selected by Jenna and our trainer, Pat Nolan. Mm-hmm. And they went down to 341st down in Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, and looked for the various criteria that they had for selecting a dog for this type of work.
These dogs were procured to be a part of our Department of Defense military working dog enterprise, and we were able to select them before they were imprinted on any odors.
Nice. Nice.
How many floppies versus pointies?
Yeah, that's a good question.
So ideally, we would have used all floppy ears. They're just a little bit easier to manage, but the DOD does not really use a whole lot of floppy ear dogs. So most of the DOD dogs, like a large majority, maybe 95%, are dual purpose for patrol and some sort of scent detection discipline, either explosives or narcotics. And that patrol work does require the pointy ear dogs. So all of them were pointy ears. They were very difficult to manage, and that part's not ideal. But, you know, we work with what we've got. And, you know, at the end of the day, a pointy ear versus a floppy ear are, we would consider fairly equivalent in their ability to do detection work.
We would have taken a dual purpose lab, though.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Hashtag team floppy right here.
Yes.
Yeah. Amen. Yep. Black lives matter.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
First, Jenna, edit that out.
It's okay.
And so, Crystal's muted, so we're like, you know. We're
yeah.
Like,
well, I do have one pointy. You,
yeah,
so,
you're kind of.
And Bristol would like to be a pointy. She's.
I could crop Ember's ears and maybe make them point up.
She could be that.
Yeah, I think so. She's got that feisty little spicy attitude.
She's got some snark in there.
I've got kind of the pointy floppies here. I've got, I call them pointy floppies. They're just kind of not super flops. They're not super flops.
So Lauren could be pointy ear for sure.
Yeah. What do you guys consider the big ahas out of this study?
Oh, there's a lot. So Lauren, hit it first.
I thought the most interesting / concerning was the lack of reproducibility between aids that came from the same manufacturer. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we did was we bought two training aids from each manufacturer at the same time. So presumably they were made out of the same lot. Obviously, we don't know that for sure. And then we bought a third one from most of them a year and a half later. And what really surprised us that even the ones that were from the same lot did not necessarily have the same amount or the same type of odor on them. They weren't identical. So that was pretty surprising. And there was some that had no odor on one and odor on the other, at least that we could detect. For all we know, the dogs could smell odor, but my instrument couldn't. The dogs could be better than our instrument. So there was definitely that. I do know that one of the manufacturers changed the way they made the training aid over that year and a half. So that one, I expected it to look different. So that was neither here nor there, but the other ones, that was really kind of shocking.
I mean, that has some major implications really on how people really kind of need to train. And
yeah, you know, one of the nice things that's come out of it is one of the manufacturers has reached out to me and said, "Hey, what do you think about," and he actually was messaging me today, with ideas of how to improve reproducibility. And I really appreciate that. I think that is just the best you could expect one of the manufacturers in the study to take it. And really a fantastic outcome would be.
How do we have better quality control?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been a really good discussion. I think they have some really good ideas. So we'll see how that goes.
Oh, excellent.
Wow.
Other ahas.
Yeah.
So we learned a lot in the process about learning during the test event. And so Lauren talks about this a lot in her lectures about, you know, what's so great about working with dogs and what's awful about working with or difficult about working with dogs. And it's that they're living, learning creatures. So they have been fantastic in terms of picking up a very sort of salient odor and running with it and being able to tell the difference between the signal and the noise. But they're also learning during test events. So, you know, we had some really in-depth conversations with Dr. Nathan Hall from Texas Tech University, who was in the process while we were doing this of getting his work published on spontaneous generalization. And the throughout testing, the first exposure of that dog to there's the, you know, the odor that it was trained on, and then there's what we would call the probe, like the test odor.
Okay.
And that first inspection and exposure of the dog to that probe odor. So, you know, that would be the what we called like the true material or the real thing. Mm-hmm. Is that's the instance that measures spontaneous generalization. And all subsequent exposures and inspections are generalization in general, but not necessarily spontaneous generalization. And so we get dogs that generalize and spontaneously generalize, and those are somewhat different. But what we realized was important was the number of exposures to TATP, and that really you do need even the dogs that were trained on the pure TATP that the FBI graciously made and made available for us. Those dogs even struggled in testing to spontaneously generalize to TATP. So I think it's one of those odors that is going to require multiple exposures in order to have the dogs be proficient in their detection of it.
Is it because that the is it like the substance, is it just very variable, or is it the vapor pressure, or what makes that substance, you know, challenging in terms of the generalization?
From my side, I don't honestly understand why it's difficult, because it's the simplest of the types of the explosives. Most of them, the explosive itself is very low vapor pressure, so the explosive itself is not available as an odor to smell. So it's other things.
Yeah.
And if you have different manufacturers, you can have different ratios of those, or you can have different background odors or different contaminants. But with TATP, the actual molecule of TATP likes to be in the gas phase so we can smell it. So it should be and there's not a lot else up there. So it should be one of the easier ones. So it's actually a little bit shocking that they did not spontaneously generalize even from one bulk TATP to another bulk TATP made by the same people. Because if that was difficult, then you can imply that a lot of the other things would be difficult. So HMTD, for instance, is really particularly challenging because it degrades into all kinds of different stinky stuff that changes over time.
Yeah. And I think you said that or if I understand it correctly, that what they're smelling with the HMTD is actually what it degrades into, not the actual component itself.
Yeah. HMTD it's a bit debatable what the vapor pressure is, but it's really irrelevant what it actually is. The point is that it's extremely low and we're not smelling it. We're smelling, but there's a lot of really smelly things that come off of it at very high quantities. There's a fish smell, a vinegar smell, all kinds of awful stuff.
Oh, it sounds amazing.
Oh no, it's disgusting.
yes, that's really, really horrible.
Yeah, it's awful. It's not a pleasant smell. Yeah. But as it degrades, it gives off large quantities. So there's no reason that your brain or nose would want to work so hard to smell the actual molecule when all these other things that you can really easily pick up are present. Wow.
And for those people out there who are listening in who are like, why is this a big deal? Explosives, I equate a lot to, you have different explosives manufacturers all over the United States. And it's sort of like giving a chocolate cake recipe to different people. Just because you gave them the same chocolate cake recipe, the cake molecularly may not be the same thing, because you may level off your one cup of flour. I may do heaping cups of flour, so it will still go boom, but it doesn't smell the same to the dogs. So this is why the generalization question comes in on how fast can they generalize across training aids. And then you guys were doing this specific study around the commercially available and basically doing quality control on all of that, which is fantastic because as someone who doesn't have a magazine on my property for my bomb dogs, I rely on those over-the-counter type of, I think of them as over-the-counter instead of off-the-shelf, but whatever.
Robin, that's a phenomenal analogy. And I like that a lot about the chocolate cake. And so all of those people are essentially making chocolate cake, right, at the end of the day. But they are all going to be slightly different in taste, texture, all that, reproducibility, all that good stuff. So I think that's a great take-home message that there is a lot of variability in the training aids just inherently. And then I think there's a lot of variability that we as a canine community could do better at controlling through proper QA, QC processes that the manufacturers follow.
And I know you guys see a whole bunch of different dogs and sort of the impetus. One of the things I guess I'm interested in is, have you seen dogs in transition from having trouble transitioning from training aids to real stuff, especially if they're done? And we might need to talk about the difference between a pseudo and an absorption and all of that first.
Where do you want to start?
Let's do the difference between an absorption and a pseudo and all of that sort of stuff.
So the terms are always in the community vary a little bit here and there. But OSAC, which I'm not even going to get into what OSAC is, if you know what it is, great. If not, doesn't matter.
We'll include a link in the show notes. If you want to read it, you can.
But there's a standards body that is attempting to define what these mean. So I'm going to give you those. So we're looping everything in under the umbrella of alternative training aid, which is basically anything that's not like the block of explosive or the actual smokeless powder or what have you. So those are all alternative training aids. In explosives, they're usually just called non-detonables, but this applies to drugs and human remains and all kinds of stuff. And human remains are always non-detonable, so that term doesn't obviously work.
But there's alternatives, though. There's pseudos of that available.
Okay, under alternatives, we have mimics, sorptions, and dilutions. So mimics are, some chemist said these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different chemicals make up the smell of whatever it is I want to detect. So I'm going to buy those chemicals and I'm going to decide how to put them on a substrate and in what amounts and what ratios. And then I'm going to make this thing that smells like the real material based on the chemicals. They can be very risky because somebody can get that formulation wrong, or they cannot understand what odorants are important to the dog's detection. But on the other hand, these are the compounds that are specifically related to the material. So if you're thinking about drugs, we don't have we don't have to worry about any kind of masking agent or diluent or anything like that. So there's pluses and minuses to those for sure. And then you have sorption aids, which could be something you buy or it can be homemade, but these are like, I have a cotton ball and I'm sticking it in a jar above my explosive. I'm going to sorb that explosive odor onto the cotton ball. And now I'm going to use that cotton ball as a training aid. Obviously the cotton ball won't last very long. I mean, there are different versions of this. You can buy get sent tubes and you can make them yourself. Or some of the commercially available training aids use sorbent materials. So again, these can be very useful because they are taking a snapshot of whatever the material is that they sorbed. So they can be very useful for that reason, but they can also be problematic because they're taking a snapshot of whatever it is that they sorbed. So if it has some kind of contaminant and that's the only training aid you ever trained on, your dog is going to include that contaminant in the odor picture. And then the third one is dilution aid. And this is more commonly used with explosives and less so with the other types of targets. But this is where you take a little bit of the real material and you mix it in with some kind of substrate to the point in which it's now non-detonable or non-hazardous. And that is the, upside to that is it's usually very pure material. Downside is that a lot of time they don't have a ton of odor on them.
Well, that you probably have to proof off of the substrate as well.
You always have to, for all of them, what's in common is they all have a substrate. Need to look for blanks when you or right. negatives or whatever you want to call them when you purchase these, whether this is explosives or not, you want to make sure that the company sells a blank and it's actually identical. Needs to be the substrate just without the odor on it.
Right.
Yep.
And the bag and the packaging.
Or your dog's just going to be alerting on cotton balls all over the place.
Exactly.
So have you guys seen in dogs transition and not be able to do the generalization from the over-the-counter stuff onto actual stuff?
I mean, I don't know about Michelle and Jenna, but I've heard anecdotal evidence on both sides. But it's usually the people that want to make a point one way or the other. So it's hard.
Loaded anecdotes.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why the scientific study was important. But I don't know if Jen and Michelle have a different experience than I have.
No, I agree completely.
Well, and Michelle, I do know we did a webinar, I think a couple of years ago, on how to validate training aids. It's still out on the Canine Census website. So I'll include a link to that if people are really interested on how you actually design a study to validate a training aid. It's out there. So what do you think that this particular study that you guys did, how will that affect possibly certification standards? Or I know, Lauren, you already talked about, you have a manufacturer that reached out to you and said, okay, how do we be more consistent? What else do you see coming out of this study?
Jen and I were just laughing in the background saying that we would say to all the manufacturers, you're welcome. That we did $1 million of research for you and take it for what you will, right? And I think this is, I don't know if
it's an opportunity to do better.
Yeah, opportunity to do better. I don't know if the word exposing would be right because it's not like an expose. But I think that
it was a third party test that most people have to pay for.
Right. And I would say that in canine, I feel like it's very much the Wild West, that the only things that are regulated are medicine and food, and all of our other devices, training aids, wearables, whatever they are, they don't need any third party testing or any sort of certification or regulation at all. And it's very much buyer beware. And when you have marketers behind things and a lot of agendas and all that other stuff, I think that the messages get a little bit mixed up and crosswired. So, I think that the research that Lauren's doing is really important. She doesn't have an agenda. She is doing research that's really valuable to the canine community and answering questions that are coming to her. Like, she's not doing research just for the fun of it. There really is questions about, we need to train on fentanyl. Fentanyl's a threat. And, Lauren's doing the deep dive analysis to try and figure out what are some potential common odorants associated with not just fentanyl, but all of the other synthetic opioid derivatives. So I know it's a little off topic, but, essentially we're learning a ton about the standards that are out there and raising the bar, because I believe that our dogs do deserve that.
I think our hope is that this will bring more light to exactly what Michelle is talking about it being, kind of the Wild West, where anything goes and nobody really knows nobody when they're buying things knows what to look for. So I think the hope is that the consumer starts to ask more questions. And I've had a couple of other manufacturers we didn't even study because they didn't have anything commercially available at the time. And another one that is in the study talked to me about validating their full line of materials and doing a full validation. Now, these companies have money to pay me to do that, and not all small startups do. But the hope is that if we can get the customer talking and asking questions, then that will push the manufacturers to have to do third-party testing. And wouldn't it be great if all the manufacturers out there did third-party testing so we could get pieces of paper and put them next to each other and say, okay, this one has this, this, and this. I want this one.
So what are those questions that, because I was just thinking that I need to go probably refresh some of my training aids for both my narcotics and my explosives dogs. What are some of those questions that I should be asking?
So having a blank, that was where I brought that up. You should be able to purchase a blank. That should be available. You want to know if they're doing any kind of QA/QC. It should come with some piece of paper that gives you some indication of the purity of the explosive they're using. I think it would be good to know if you're dealing with a sorption, dilution, or mimic. That would be useful. Michelle or Jenna, what comes to your guys' mind?
Shelf life, service life.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
And cost.
Yeah, so I will say though, I mean, we have this wish list of, or even I think what would be a standard in any other field of what should accompany a training aid. Just like it would accompany a calibration standard that Lauren's using for her GCMS instruments. But I will say that based on our study, there's an expense involved in this that is, I would say, prohibitive for a lot of companies that are out there. And so because canine in general and the working dog community in general is so under-resourced that there would be need to be an injection of funding and resources and capabilities that would help supplant or, you know, complement some of the work that's already being done.
Well, the hope is that if some of the manufacturers can't give you answers, they should be able to be honest about that's not something we've been able to do, or we've done this internally, we haven't been able to do. Like, you should get real answers. You should not get politics where somebody is tap dancing around the true answer.
Well, kind of like the food industry, right? They say that it is field trial or laboratory trial. Like, we have an idea of what type of testing has gone on behind it.
Or there'll be a thing that says it has not been FDA approved.
Right.
It'd be good to know.
Yeah, the agriculture industry does a lot of this with, you know, they'll do a new strain of seed and they actually do field trials. Mm. And they send it to universities and they say, okay, put it out in the field. Does the marketing claim, does it do what we are going to claim it to do? And it actually has to go through that stuff before it even goes out to market. I mean, if people want to know, it's like a 12-year approval process to get a new genetic trait put out in a seed. I used to work in the agriculture industry, and this is why I know that.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it though, that what's driving that is actually safety on the back end, right?
Yes, it is.
So I think this is kind of what boggles my mind is that I know a lot of the funding isn't there, but this also drives safety. This drives, you know, are the dogs detecting explosives out there in the real world, which hopefully there aren't that many, but you know what I mean? So that kind of boggles my mind that the funding's not readily, you know what I mean?
Dogs were this fantastic little black box that seemed to figure out what we want them to do in spite of the human at the other end of the leash.
Yeah.
And so it's hard.
Yeah. Lauren and I were talking about that on the podcast with Jeff Meyer, saying that I believe that dogs are able to do what they do in spite of us, not because of us. Yeah. And we really don't give them a leg up on any of these detection capabilities. But I think there's a little bit of, like you said, Robin, it's a black box, right? So it looks a little bit like magic from the outside. Mm-hmm. And people don't realize all of the work that goes into getting these dogs up to proficiency to find these various explosive odors or drug odors. And unless you have a large push and education campaign to inform the decision makers and the budget people about, you know, how resource intensive this really is, I think the money will still continue to get funneled towards the instruments, the handheld detectors, things like that, things that are sort of easier for people to wrap their head around.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, bear in mind, we don't know what the dogs are missing in the real world, right?
Because they miss them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Unless there's and then if there's some incident, let's say there's an explosion and the dog did miss something, it's going to be that dog that's blamed, or that dog wasn't put in the right place in order to sniff it or what have you. But
oh my gosh, it's an exact thing that's always 100%, right?
Right. So at no point does anybody say, oh, maybe we just aren't training the dog to find real life
thing.
Threats.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe they're not generalized.
Yeah. So I think the other part of that is in general, we need to be, as a canine community, more transparent. We need to be humbled by our strengths and you know, weaknesses. We need to admit our capabilities and limitations. Everything has them. Mm-hmm. And people need to know what the left and right bounds of whatever device or capability you are that you're putting out there. And there's no shame in that. Like that is really every tool in the toolbox has a strength and a weakness. And I think we need to be good stewards of the information. And I think the publications go a long way to demonstrate that. So, you know, with the project with Naval Research Lab and then FIU is spanning 4 years. We did this during, you know, the height of COVID. We managed to be very flexible in what we required and what we needed in order to still get this project done in really difficult times. And as you can see by the paper, it's, you know, 19 pages. It's a ton of data, a ton of work. And it is one of the first studies that has the analytical chemistry behind it and the canine data that validates it. And I'm hoping that we get to a point where we can do more of that type of work, because as Lauren says, it is really important to have both.
I think the only other one that has that's training aids that has the analytical chemistry and the dog trial is human remains, and the training aids that were tested aren't even used anymore. And there was, you know, easily a decade if between that study and this study. So I think that's something that a place that we obviously need to improve.
Well, something else to add to that too is the whole purpose of this study was for the Department of Defense. We want a non-detonable, non-hazardous training aid that our men and women and four-legged soldiers can take overseas. And I say soldiers because we're Army, but let's face it, it's a whole military working dog enterprise, plus all those other military working dog teams, as well as our allies. Like, this is something that we want. We have places where we are not allowed to have explosive training aids. We need to have something that is non-detonable. So this is the work to push us to get to that space where we can have these products to allow for our teams to continue to train.
Makes a lot of sense.
And absolutely. I don't think, you know, that's one of those things that until I started hanging out in this space, I didn't realize that, you know, sometimes when we send our soldiers overseas, they can't take training aids with their dogs.
Wow. Yeah, there's a lot of nuance that people don't necessarily realize. And not just overseas, there's places within the US that are non-permissive, like that would not allow our training aids to be in. So this is really a high priority for, I would say, both the Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security. Lauren, would you say that this study invalidates or validates any other previous studies?
No, I would not. There are no studies, as we said, that have dog and explosives in it that are in peer reviewed. So there might be other studies out there. There are probably other studies out there that do things like this, but if they are underneath layers of security where nobody can read them, then, you know, that's
they do no good. Right.
Yeah, they do absolutely no good. There are some older studies that have dog and training aids in them in a certain capacity, but they are not the same explosives that we looked at, nor are they the same manufacturers, so you can't compare apples and oranges. Just because something worked or didn't work for TATP has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not it would work for HMTD, C4, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, thank you so much for pointing that out. Because, you know, I think there's a politicization of science and of our research, and trying to extract sentences or pieces of data without the context is really disingenuous, and doesn't really serve anyone at the end of the day. So I really appreciate Lauren advocating for the outcomes of this study. Our job as scientists is not to endorse a specific product. It is to report our findings and inform the consumer. And so then they can make decisions based on scientific evidence as opposed to marketing claims. And really, as much as we are you know, focused on getting that information out there, we really, at the end of the day, we want those consumers to be more informed. And I think handlers really want the red light, green light, yes, no, black and white type of answers. And really, reality does not exist in that space. It is an area of gray. And we talk often with different types of canine end users and agencies that have different sets of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. So for a false alarm rate, let's just an example. For a false alarm rate, if you have a false alarm, so something wasn't there, right? And your detector goes bing, whether that's a dog or a handheld. And the consequence of that, the impact of that, is that you close down an entire airport, an international airport. It's an international incident. You have to call. There's a whole protocol you need to follow that involves calling in EOD and all these other things, right? So it's going to impact thousands and thousands of people. If that is your scenario, then you need, I would say, a very low false alarm rate. It's not going to be acceptable to have a high false alarm rate in those situations. There's other end users we have where a ping or, you know, a sensor going off is just a cue to do further interrogation of that sample or that vehicle or that person, what have you. And the consequence isn't necessarily, or doesn't necessarily have the impact of my previous example. So there are trade-offs in everything. And what is acceptable to one person may not be acceptable to another. And you're not going to get that type of transparent information from someone that is pushing an agenda or pushing a product or what have you. And so, you know, I think that's especially why it's important to have the academics be doing this type of research that do not have conflicts of interest, real, potential, or perceived, because that's what we want to cover. And so, you know, there's people like Lauren and Nathan Hall and Lucia Lazarowski and Cindy Otto. There's wonderful, wonderful canine researchers out there that really don't have an agenda. They just want to get that good information out there.
And so that's a great point. That's a really great point, because it's all about the risk assessment, right? And you know, what kind of risk people want to carry. You know, I also wonder, and you know, this just thoughts going through my head, is that I'm always kind of thinking about it, you know, from the human perspective versus the dog perspective, right? So from, I know I have a very poor sense of smell just in general, and I would say every person does compared to a dog. That, but we don't have that perspective that a dog has, so we don't really know what they perceive. And I think it's really easy to make assumptions and judgments as a human when we have this very simplistic, simplistic idea of like a odor, and extrapolate that to dogs. And when you look at the number of scent receptors, it's just ridiculous. You know, so, you know, I always have to wonder, is that, you know, is that a driver of all that also?
I was thinking about the absorption, a mimic, and the other one. I can't remember the other one.
Sorption, mimic, and dilution.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And thinking about actually consulting and the dilution type of stuff, I know, Lauren, one of the first episodes we did, you were talking about if you're doing adsorption, it's really important to use like cotton balls and something else because things stick differently.
Yeah, that was a great episode.
In my very non-scientific way.
Right? Yeah.
And so, you know, and then I also know from some of my training of the importance of allowing sometimes your mimics to vent, because in the overhead space, what you think the dog is alerting to, yeah. which, you know, in my case, I'm like, I really want you responding to RDX. Mm-hmm. But given the carrier chemicals, he actually learned to respond to the carrier chemicals, which is really the importance of having a blank.
Yeah, that's a problem on dilution aids. Also, a lot of the way that they get the really small amount of explosives onto the substrate is that they dissolve it in a solvent and they put that onto the substrate and they evaporate the solvent off. And you could evaporate 99.9% of the solvent off, but there's still enough there.
Yeah.
The main component. There's still enough there that it's technically something you could smell, but it's going to evaporate off entirely way before your explosive related chemical does. So that is a good reason to let it vent or air off a little bit, off gas a bit before you use the training aid. We did see that. We saw for the TTP training aids, we saw acetone in almost all of them initially, but most of them, the acetone was gone after the first use or very close to gone.
Crystal, we would like to answer your wonderful question from the chat about, do we think it's even possible for an HMTD training aid to be made? And I would like to just kickstart this by saying that I think that is the power of the adsorption aids, the aids that are absorbing odor onto the surface of whatever material they're using, because you can grab a snapshot of the different phases of HMTD from fresh to, you know, early degradation to the end where it really just does smell like fish, like Lauren was talking about earlier. Yeah. And so that's something that you're not necessarily going to be able to achieve with a different technology applied to that HMTD training aid, right, Lauren?
Unless somebody is, and this would be, and from the chemist's perspective, like it would be really hard to do, but unless somebody's making a mimic and they are making multiple variations of, like we've done it in the lab where I've made multiple variations of HMTD odor, but it's not easy. It would be probably really expensive thing to do. It makes much more sense to get a bunch of those odor snapshots and have your dog, you know, generalize the odor of HMTD.
So for the lay handler listening, this basically what you're saying is that if you don't, you know, expose your dog to the different points in time, that your dog could actually be trained to just detect the explosive at a certain age.
Yeah, HMTD is a really severe example. So if you look at very fresh HMTD, it smells like solvent. It had, like, at least to me, I don't know that the dogs perceive the odor the same way I do, but this is the best we got. Right. And my instrument matches what I smell. So it smells very, very solventy because it has a lot of formaldehyde when they first make it. So I feel like people can kind of picture what that might smell like. And then it starts to produce formic acid, which is similar to acetic acid. So vinegar. So it's just smelling vinegar. And then as it gets older, it gets this trimethylamine, which smells, it is like an insanely strong fish smell. So it actually transitions from this like solventy to vinegary to fishy. And that, you know, if you presumably you're not training the dog on crazy fresh, right? Because like you can only have that for a second. But it's very distinctly possible that somebody has made material and is transporting it. So it could be extremely fresh that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. So you would want, if you could capture that smell on a on a sorption aid or something like that, then you can have that. You can save that snapshot of that smell and mm-hmm. make sure your dogs understand that as well as the older material.
Fantastic point, Dr. DeGrief. I would also say that we can get, from the military perspective, we can find a cache overseas and co-incubate. So put a sorption aid or material substrate, whatever you want, like a Getsen tube, in the same environment as that cache that we found and start training our dogs back on the forward operating base, the FOB, to detect that aid. And again, another technology to get at the same detection proficiency capability, but something that you're not going to be able to achieve by any of the other means of creating an alternative training aid. So I think there's a really strong place in the community for having many tools in this toolbox and not necessarily relying on just one. Dr. DeGrief, I also have a question about
Dr. Mon.
Yes, what your comment would be about someone that claims to be a scientist that would say, "I've never been proven wrong in science," end quote.
What's the question?
All right, I'll repeat it if you didn't hear it clearly the first time. I would ask for a comment about what you would say about someone who claims to be a scientist that, quote, "I've never been proven wrong in science," end quote.
Well, I was on the stand testifying back in December, and the person who was cross-examining me kept pointing to the paper that I wrote and said, "This doesn't say proved. This doesn't say proved." And he kept pointing to different spots in my expert witness write-up thing. And I said, "That's right, because scientists would never use that terminology. We don't say we proved anything. We would say this, you back it off one from there. This is likely." We liked likely.
So I love that, because the scientists are known for their qualifiers. And I consider myself an expert in this area because I watched Neil deGrasse Tyson's masterclass. And so I would say that you're correct, and that science doesn't prove or disprove anything, but it furthers the knowledge base that we have as humans with our little brains.
There's nothing that you have said so far that I think is wrong, by the way.
So I have a question as somebody who puts out my training aids and like lets them sit, because I'm so going to do I'm a practitioner. I have a question. How do explosives age on the chemical level over time or exposure to the environment? So, I mean, you guys were doing this set stuff with TATP and HMTD. And why did you pick those two? We'll start there. And then does your stuff change as you set it out?
So we picked those two because of that they're the most difficult to work with. And so that's what people need the most for a training aid. Because of that, because they are sensitive and they like to explode by themselves. And they're scary to work with. So that's why we chose those. How a training aid ages when you put it out is going to depend on the particular type of explosive that it is. I mean, at this point, to clarify, at this point, are we talking real explosives? Okay.
Yes.
So,
please.
Okay. So it's going to depend on what that explosive is. So for instance, C4, which is, you know, like a plasticized explosive, the parts of it that there are plasticizers and solvents in it, and some of those are going to evaporate off faster. So you're going to lose some of those highly volatile things fast. And so your fresher is going to smell different than your older. The problem with something like C4 is that you don't know how long it sat on the shelf. And Jenna is a very big fan of talking about this. It's a really good point. You don't know how long it sat on the shelf before you purchased it. So you don't have a particularly large amount of control over what it is that you're getting.
There's no expiration date, like a milk, like, you know, stamp on your jug of milk or anything, like, you know, like use before.
They don't care, because they don't care about it.
Yeah.
Predominantly, they're not selling to they just want it to go boom. So they don't really care what it smells like.
Right.
Although that being said, the plasticized explosives have a tagant in them. And so that gives the dogs a good target. The tagant is, has a lot of odor. It's very volatile. It's easy to detect. That's actually why it's there. So that helps. But different types of explosives are going to age differently. A lot of them are very stable. TNT doesn't do anything terribly exciting. over time. But they all are going to get contaminated. So that's a big one, is that you set it out for a long time. And if you set it out someplace stinky, it's going to absorb where whatever is around. And that's actually, God willing, we're going to have a paper on that soon. Hopefully, if Catherine is listening to this, you should be writing right now instead. We did some work where we put different types of materials out in different training scenarios and looked at see how contaminated it gets. And they definitely do, but it's the true material that gets contaminated. It's also the substrates. So all of those, you know, non-detonables have substrates. Those get contaminated. But the one positive thing that we did find is that if you contaminate it and you bring it back out of the field and you let it sit in an odor, well, there's no such thing as odor-free, but relatively odor-free environment for as little as 15 minutes, you can off-gas a lot of that odor. And so when you put it away, it doesn't stay in that training aid. If you pull the training aid out of the field, like let's say you had it hidden under a car where there's a lot of odor and you put it away, you're just locking in all of that contaminated odor. If you let it off gas for just like a little bit of time, you can do a lot of good.
Oh, wow.
Fun facts.
Oh, that was like my one aha moment for pulling my aids out and probably just letting them sit someplace for 15 minutes before.
You can also do it before you put them out in the field too. Throw them out, let them sit for a second. Huh. And it's...
Well, but if you put them away... you know, too early. I'm just kind of thinking about this. And you put them in the, you know, whatever you're putting in, like a Mylar bag or whatever, right? Wouldn't that, could that make the contamination worse, like a little bit more ingrained?
I think so, but I haven't tested that.
No, I'm not asking you to prove anything.
My
That's
gut
why
says,
I'm just putting that out there.
Gut says that it would sink deeper into the sponge.
Yeah,
it would be harder. It would take longer, but I don't know that for sure. But
yeah, it's an interesting question, though.
It is.
Yeah.
But we did learn from the study that ammonium nitrate is particularly spongy. I thought we put C4 out. We thought C4 would be really likely to pick up contaminating odor because it's plasticky.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sticky. But ammonium nitrate really, it sucks up everything.
Wow.
So,
okay. Huh. That's interesting to know from a setting stuff out standpoint on, yeah. I really need another barrier between my ammonium nitrate aids and wherever I'm setting them down in the little bag that they come in is not sufficient.
Well, you have to worry about physical transfer.
Correct.
Dirt is a different problem, but just as far as like odor absorbing onto it, it does come back off. It's just ammonium nitrate was just particularly readily contaminated.
Oh, that's interesting.
Cool.
It also makes you think about like the other odors, like the applicability to other non-explosive odors.
Do you guys have plans to look at this for narcotics or any of those other types? I know it's a Department of Defense thing, which may not be quite so interested in narcotics, but.
No, I'm working with Customs and Border Patrol a lot. Oh, you mean for the training aids? Nobody will fund that.
That's unfortunate.
Huh. I know. You should tell your viewers to find me funding. I'm sure. We all get on board to do this with the narcotics training aids. Also, it really needs to be done with everything.
Yeah. Agreed, Dr. DeGrief. I would say that these are issues that are pervasive in canine, and it's not just about funding you or Nathan or Lucia or Cindy. It's really about having an investment in olfactory sciences and wanting more out of the exploration of how our dogs are able to do what they're do.
What they're do?
What they
what
do.
What kind of English was that?
What they're do.
Wow. Go home, you're drunk.
Sorry. My friend Kendall Jackson has made an appearance.
Of course.
Oh, white or red.
Oh my gosh. So since we have all three of you on the phone, I want to know what else you're working on.
Oh, well, hold on to your butts because Lauren's
got
a ton of stuff. Lauren, you hit it.
Oh, God, it's a list. Okay, I've got a lot going on with contamination. I'll get the sneak preview of that is in the narcotics training aids, everything just smells like heroin.
I thought it was marijuana.
Oh no. Well, I didn't have marijuana involved because now that's like,
that's
include marijuana in the study. Don't include marijuana in the study. It's very confusing. If you exclude marijuana from it, everything smells like heroin. That was really fun. We're working on a cross-contamination indicator. So it's a little colorimetric guy that can sit in your kit and tell you when you think odors are starting to move between your training.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
Yep. Wow. Got to work on that, but it's moving along nicely. I'm working with oil detection. I have a couple of human remains detection projects. We're dealing with vapor as it comes out of buried explosives, all kinds of good stuff.
That's so cool.
Hmm. Aren't you doing some human remains stuff?
I have a couple of human remains projects. I have one that's actually happening, and then I have a theoretical one that Robin might know something about. So I have one where we're trying to figure out when the smell of when living scent turns to dead scent. So immediately after you die, how long do you smell like a living person as opposed to a dead person?
Yeah. Which is actually really important in my world.
Yeah.
Lauren, I think we have a paper coming out that actually might help elucidate or speak to some of the answers that you're looking. I know it's a big word. Sorry. To answer what's going on with that. Dr. Peterman at Texas Tech is Paola is publishing a paper currently about the contribution of human breath to the human scent profile. And so it's super interesting that when you separate the breath from the human scent in general, like outside of breath, you have a massive and marked significant decrease in canine detection of humans and
that's
human
interesting.
Brain. Yeah, it's super interesting.
Oh, Lauren, you're in for this, right?
Yeah. Hold on to your butt, Lauren, because this paper is coming out and
mind blown.
Yeah. And so I think that depending on how you train your dog, that distinction between when a human is alive and dead and those different odor profiles is going to be pretty marked.
Look at Robin's face. Robin's like, give me your data.
Pretty much, yes.
She wants the D.
I want your bark barrels.
I do. Well, it's really important for our FEMA dogs. Mm-hmm. That type of work is really important for the FEMA dog. So it has direct correlation over that way and to any of the live fine versus cadaver dogs that were, you're training. Because one of the problems that we have with the cadaver dogs is how fresh is, we can't get fresh bodies most of the time. And so it's hard.
Yep. We have some data from the research studies that you assisted with.
Yes.
With some of your FEMA counterparts.
Yes.
So Robin actually was instrumental in helping us elucidate some of the mechanisms behind live human scent detection and the odor profiles that are associated with that. So
that study got approved and it's coming out in Frontiers, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Not Frontiers. It's coming out in Separation Science. And that's the study that I'm referencing from Dr. Tiedemann. So there's that study. Nathan Hall's doing another one, but there's a lot of really fascinating research about
Dr. Edgar Alves.
Yes.
Avilas Rosa.
Yeah. So we have, some of the top tier scientists in canine research that are putting out data that really help support what you guys are already doing from the FEMA standpoint.
These dogs do amazing things that even our instruments cannot do.
Correct.
It's awesome.
Awesome. Okay, ladies, Jenna and Michelle, do you guys have any other stuff that's coming out?
Yes, a lot. What can we talk about? Okay, so we are working on inkjet printed coupons, meaning you can put explosives into a printer cartridge, just like you have a printer cartridge at home in your printer. I see Stacey Barnett's eyebrow going.
My brain just blew up.
On that.
So printing explosives.
Instead of instead of, printing ink, you can print explosives. And
so it's like a 3D printer for bombs.
Yeah, basically. And so when
inkjet printer, right?
Yeah. So when Lauren's talking about, well, how do you know, because we're talking about 0.2 milligrams or 2 milligrams or 10 milligrams, how do you know how much your dogs are actually detecting? We can tell you from that standpoint, so because
we can quantitate it now.
We can quantitate it, yeah. So what is fantastic about that capability is that by printing it on some sort of substrate, whether we're using Wattman filter paper or what have you, that renders that explosive non-detonable. And you can mail it through the regular USPS. So that would be a huge capability gap filler for, again, our warfighters overseas that are in environments or countries where our canine explosive scientists are not permitted. So we're working on that. And we also are working on personal protective equipment for dogs. We're working on what we would call Project Iron Dog, which is a performance assessment platform. So dogs that can be repeatedly measured for how they perform under exercise stress. And so a lot of our detection studies right now, even certifications, it's basically a dog at a pretty leisurely pace or walking, not really under a whole lot of stress. So we have a system where we can put dogs on treadmills and see if they can detect odorants from Dr. Nathan Hall's olfactometer on the front of the treadmill, and how that performance decrement will increase as exercise intensity increases. So working on that. What else, Jenna?
Decon.
Oh, decontamination. So canine decontamination. Dr. Aaron Perry from Southern Illinois University has really pioneered and taken the helm on this aspect, and came up with some great protocols during COVID. But we also want to add to that and make sure that there's proper tactics, techniques, and procedures, TTPs, for military working dogs that may get contaminated from a chemical or biological threat overseas. So there's all sorts of things that are going on. That's just a couple of them, but all of them have relevance and importance to the warfighter. Over.
Amazing.
Awesome. Ladies, we usually ask at the end of our podcast what your takeaway is, or what you would like people to take away from this particular discussion. So my question, Lauren, we can start with you. What's your takeaway
from this whole discussion?
Yes.
Other than Michelle and Jenna have been drinking?
Yes.
My takeaway from this discussion, I guess, is that there are just so many questions out there that operational people, as yourselves, need answered. And, it's all about getting the funding and the interest of the people with money to let us do that research, because it is obviously something that the community needs and wants.
Two things: be an advocate for your dog and be an advocate for yourself. And the third thing, ask questions. Like, we're allowing for a lot of these companies just to sling their items, and we're not asking the right questions that we know are needed to be answered, but we're not stable enough to get it out there because we're worried about being sharpshooted. We want to be an awesome handler. We want to have the best dog. We want to have the best training aids. But until we advocate for ourselves and our dogs, it's not going to happen.
Very true. Stacy.
Well, I'm just sitting here going, I knew this whole thing was complex. And now, like, I'm just like, it just took it to like, the next level. There's so much to think about, but it also gets my brain kind of going in terms of just training and the implication of how you need to train and how you really need to think about the different permutations if you really want to have a really well-trained dog.
Amen. I would like to add that I think what Lauren and Jenna and I advocate for is varying your training. So as much variation as possible is going to be the key for success. Whether that is training with different organizations, different training aids, different environments like hot and cold and light and dark and humid and non-humid, get your dog into as many situations as you can, and they will be uncomfortable, but they will ultimately lead to a better capability. Lauren, I think you have something to add to that.
Embrace the suck.
I was going to say is that you don't have to worry. I completely agree. And this is something that I talk about in my seminars a lot also, but you don't have to actually worry about all the different permutations as long as you know that you're giving the dog as many variations as you reasonably can. And then you don't have to start saying, oh, did I do this? Did I do that? Did I just, you know, change it up as often as possible.
All right, ladies, anything else for the good of the order that you would like to share?
The good of the order and the keeper of the realm, I would like to know if Ms. Crystal has any questions going forward, because I feel like she's been somewhat of a silent partner in this venture.
She already signed off.
Crystal is actually at the recording of this particular episode. We scheduled this because that was when Michelle, Jenna, and Lauren were free. Crystal is off giving a floor play seminar through Fenzi. So she's actually teaching a whole other group of people about floor play.
Is that like
interpretive dance?
Is that like role playing?
Yes, definitely.
It could be, or it's yeah. Right after Valentine's Day, so it might be a play on foreplay, but it's floor play.
Floor, like playing on the floor with your
dog. Like playing on the floor with your dog. Yes.
Yep. That could have been really spicy.
It could have been, but you know, we're trying to do G-rated. So there you go.
PG.
Or PG. Yep.
Damn it, Robin and Stacey, you know better than to keep us.
I know. Well, that was one.
All we have to do is put the little explicit thing
on it, and we're good. We're good.
We can cope.
So I want to say thanks to all three of you for participating and beaming in from your different realms of the world. And we definitely will have you back when you have some additional research, or if you have something else that you guys think and cool sciencey stuff that comes out. So my big takeaway was ask your manufacturers questions and demand to see data sheets that they have done third-party testing. So since I'm going to go out and purchase some.
Hell, I'd just be happy with data sheets.
data sheets would be awesome. So thank you everybody for listening, and go train.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Canine Detection Collaborative.
We appreciate the time you spend with us. If you liked this episode, not only should you follow us so you don't miss the next one, but please also rate and review us in your favorite podcast app. For info on collaborating with us, go to caninedetectioncollaborative.com. That's K9detectioncollaborative.com. Where you can find our socials and pick up our latest monthly freebie. Join us again to talk training in the next episode.